I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals this morning. Thank you for being here. We've got two cases that will be argued this morning and one that is going to be submitted without argument. It's my understanding that the attorneys have all checked in and are ready. And before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Lee Gabriel. To my left is Justice Elizabeth Kerr. And I'm Bonnie Setters. I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. Before we begin the first argument, would the clerk please call the case?
The court will now call City of Mansfield, Texas, et al. Versus Josh and Kelly Sabrium, et al. And may it please the court, this is Daniel Barrett, arguing for the appellant. Mr. Bill Warren, arguing for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Your Honor, may it please the court, counsel. Well, I guess, first of all, we need to talk about what probably is the elephant in the room, and that would be whether or not the law of the case applies to this situation, and that is whether the previous en banc opinion written by Justice Meyer should be determinative of the issues in this case. Now, we believe, obviously, that the law of the case does not apply and should not be controlling in this case for a number of reasons, two of which are primary. The first is that the issue on appeal at the time that opinion was written was the denial of the temporary injunction. That denial and that appeal was based on a very limited record with virtually no discovery having been conducted in the case. Secondly, the issue on appeal in that case was, as I've mentioned, the denial of the temporary injunction. That is, whether or not the plaintiffs had alleged a case, whether or not they had demonstrated a probability of success, and whether or not they had demonstrated irreparable harm. Now, anything else, any other pronouncement by the Court of Appeals beyond those narrow issues, any more definitive determination had to be solely dicta.
When you raise standing, how can that be dicta?
Well,
in the previous appeal,
standing would be a jurisdictional issue that could be raised at any point.
So it was necessary for the court to decide that issue.
That particular
appeal.
I'm sorry, Justice. Yes, it was necessary for the court to decide that particular issue in the context of whether or not the plaintiffs had alleged a case that was cognizable in the trial court.
Whether they had the authority or the right to raise that case is really the issue, wasn't it?
Right. And as we'll get to later, the standing issue was raised in the context of the declaration of the document. There is a completely separate standing issue that, once discovery was conducted in the case, came to the forefront. And that involves the fact that the association that was contemplated, so to speak, in the declaration, the Arbors, was not a party, never has been a party, there was no attempt to make it a party, and it is the only entity that might have been the entity to which title was transferred. The plaintiffs have never made an attempt or even played as if they had the authority under their lawsuit to represent the Arbors as opposed to the estates. The Meyer opinion, and this is just one of the illustrations of the clearly erroneous nature.
Let me stop you right there on that. The Supreme Court denied review after full briefing. You go on and on about it being clearly erroneous. If the Supreme Court of this state had decided it was clearly erroneous, they had an opportunity to review it and correct all those errors that you allege were there. After full briefing, doesn't that tell us something?
With all due respect, Justice, I don't believe that it does, because when the Supreme Court denies review, it simply does that. It denies review. And that denial does not constitute an opinion by the Supreme Court as to anything. It's just as easily possible that the Supreme Court looked at it and said, Well, you know, we have such a limited record here. It's clear that after all of this other evidence is going to have the opportunity to come forward at trial, that we're going to have another appeal. Because this is an interlocutory appeal, we're just going to wait until the whole case is up before us and we can properly make a decision on all of the merits. Because what the Meyer opinion tries to do is be an opinion on the merits of the case in the absence of the opportunity for a trial on the merits. And that thwarts the very purpose of our justice system. So the Supreme Court's denial of review, even after full briefing, I'd submit that what the full briefing did was simply inform the court, the Supreme Court, that there were a lot more issues that needed to be addressed, but that were not properly before the court in the context of the interlocutory appeal. And so the Supreme Court's denial really can't be indicative of any final determination, excuse me, other than to say, we're going to look at this later, when and if it comes to us, in the context of a full record. So, the majority of the cases, the majority of the appellate opinions out there say that an appeal from a temporary injunction should not be accorded law of the case. And it also says, and this is perhaps the most important, that this court, sitting as it is right now, has the power and has the authority to exercise its discretion to look at the prior opinion and disregard it because it is demonstrably and clearly wrong on many, many levels and for many different reasons. Now, there are three primary reasons that I'd like to discuss if time permits. The first is probably the central question, and that is, was the declaration a conveyance of the R2 lots? We believe, of course, that the declaration unambiguously did not convey anything to anyone. But no matter what the declaration may have done with any other property, the R2 lots were explicitly excluded from its scope, and therefore it did not apply to the R2 lots and it could not have conveyed them. Let's look at the timeline. There was a general plat recorded at some point, and then at some time later, a year or so maybe, there was a revision to that plat. And in the revision to that plat, the developer created, out of general lots, two categories of lots, the R1 lots and the R2 lots. After that was done, the developer wrote the declaration, and in that declaration, he drew a circle. And that circle was to encompass the scope of the declaration and to include within it everything to which the declaration would apply. He reached out and by name took the R1 lots and put them in that circle. He took some other lots that were not designated with a letter but just numbers, and he put them in that circle. What he did not do was put the R2 lots in that circle, although he had just created them and named them as such. So the extent, the scope of the authority of the declaration does not include the R2 lots. They are not included within the definition of the property, and the declaration affects only the property. It does not matter that somewhere else in the declaration, some of that scope, the property, is termed as common properties, because the R2 lots cannot be considered part of the common properties. In order for the declaration to affect anything, that land has to be included within the definition, and the R2 lots are not. Now, secondly, the Meyer opinion blithely ignores well-established Texas law that you simply cannot convey property to an entity that does not exist. When the declaration was signed, the association, as mentioned in it, did not exist. When the declaration was filed, the association did not exist. It was not dormant, it was not inchoate, and it was not awaiting any approval or resurrection. It had no legal existence at that point whatsoever. The Lighthouse case, misconstrued by both the plaintiffs and the Meyer opinion, says, and I quote, "We agree with the bank that in Texas, a deed is void, not voidable, but void, if the grantee is not in existence at the time the deed is executed." Now, the plaintiffs in the Meyer opinion seek to engraft some sort of transactional exception to that rule that's been a part of Texas real estate jurisprudence for a couple of centuries. But if you look at the entire transaction and not the small section of it that the Meyer opinion chooses to examine, the bookending events of that transaction are, one, the creation of both the R1 and the R2 lots by the plat, the dedication of those R2 lots for public recreation purposes in the plat, and then on the other end, you have the deeding of those R2 lots to the Communities Foundation of Texas. In the middle, you have the creation of the declaration in which the circle was drawn and the R1 lots were placed, not the R2 lots. So if you consider the entire transaction, there simply is no way to reconcile what actually happened with the opinion written by Justice Meyer. The third point. The association mentioned in the declaration that is subject of the suit is something that the developer obviously planned at some point to create in the future. That association, to which the Meyer opinion incorrectly states the R2 lots were conveyed, that association is the Arbers. The Arbers is not and never has been a party to this suit. The plaintiffs are not and have never been members of the Arbers. When the plaintiffs sued to act on behalf of an entity, they sued to act on behalf of the estates. The estates is a wholly separate legal entity from the Arbers. It was formed by different parties. It was not formed by the developers. It was formed by the residents themselves. And it was formed nearly 2.5 years after the transaction that's the subject of this lawsuit. That situation is fatal to this lawsuit for two reasons. And one is the standing reason that Justice Gabriel raised just a minute ago. The plaintiffs have not sought, nor do they have, standing to act on behalf of the Arbers. And it's the Arbers that is the subject of the declaration. Pardon me. And the second is, the Arbers is a necessary, indispensable party to any declaratory judgment case, not just the other cases, the other causes of action that were alleged by the plaintiffs.
Have you ever raised that before?
Pardon me?
Have you ever raised that before?
Yes, ma'am.
That they're an indispensable party?
Yes, we have raised that they're an indispensable party to the lawsuit and that the relief requested could not be granted without their presence. For no other reason, but in Chapter 37 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, the Declaratory Judgments Act, states very clearly that any party whose rights are sought to be determined must be made a party to the lawsuit.
Did the trial court make any ruling concerning that?
Yes, the trial court ruled that because of the Myers opinion, that question was moot. That's another illustration.
Actually raised in your appeal here.
Yes,
I don't recall that being an issue, anything about indispensable parties. Maybe it is. I'll go back and look.
I'm sorry, I can't from memory cite a particular section, but
expecting that at all.
But yes, I mean, the fact that the arbors, in order for the relief to be granted that was requested, the arbors had to be part of the lawsuit, it was argued in the trial court and made part of this appeal.
Okay.
Now, that's just another illustration of why, circling back to the beginning of the argument, that's just another illustration of why the law of the case is not appropriate to be applied here. And that is that at the beginning of the case, and at the time that Justice Womack denied the temporary injunction, nobody knew that there was a deficit of parties. Nobody realized that the estates had come later, that the arbors had forfeited its corporate charter, and all of that is in the record. But nobody knew it at the time, and so it illustrates why appeals of temporary injunction matters shouldn't be considered law of the case, because they deny the parties the opportunity to fully try the case and develop the evidence.
Your
now,
time is up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Bill Warren. I'm here with Caitlin Hubbard. We represent the appellees, the homeowners in the Estates of Creekwood that have brought this action. As you've heard, the appellants have brought a fruit basket of arguments, in both in their argument made today by my colleague Mr. Barrett and in their pleadings. I want to start where he began, which was with law of the case. And let me first state, we don't rely on law of the case in order to prove our case. Do we think it applies? Absolutely, we think it applies. In fact, I believe it's telling that when requesting a continuance from the trial court in this case, while the opinion from Justice Meyer was on appeal or they had sought review with the Texas Supreme Court, the city of Mansfield had made this statement to then the trial judge, Womack. Because, as this court knows, a threshold issue in this litigation is whether the declaration transferred title to the association, the disposition of that issue will control the issues to be considered in trial of this cause and will have large effect on the ultimate disposition of this litigation.
Counsel, are you taking the position that that was a binding judicial admission sort of statement?
I'm not saying it's binding, but I think it's telling, and I think it's insightful. That at one point in time, at least, the city was saying, we want relief in the form of a continuance from the court, because we're going to find out, if we wait, the result of these binding legal issues by what the Texas Supreme Court does. And now they come back and say, well, wait a minute, it turns out those are not binding, and we really didn't need that continuance because they didn't mean anything. That's, I think it's telling that that statement was made. I don't think it's binding.
Where during this process, when the city was making those statements, did it come up that, in fact, the arbors had gone away and now we have the estates in?
I don't know if I can give you period and paragraph. I know I believe it was in June or July of 2016 in the city of Mansfield. And when I talk about the city, I mean all the city defendants, so forgive me for being, if I'm misspeaking by referring to them just as the city. But the city defendants filed amended answers, and I believe special exceptions where they first brought that up. In fact, I believe that they are in our appendix to our brief. It's the city's second amended answer and their special appearance and their special exceptions. And I want to jump to that because that does refer to the judicial admission issue that we raised with respect to the arbors versus estates issue. First of all, Judge Wallach, in his summary judgment proceeding, he granted certain objections to evidence. And one of the objections to evidence he granted was our judicial admission objection, which we said was the city has made all of these arguments, all these put in evidence about the arbors being forfeited and the estates being created. They can't do that, because they've judicially admitted for years and continue to judicially admit that the estates is the appropriate entity. Justice Wallach granted that objection. Why is that important here? Because judicial admission was also a ground for summary judgment that the estates was the appropriate issue. This was not, as the city says in its brief, just some throwaway allegation that we made before the trial court. We spent four pages, which you'll find in the record, I believe, Volume 6, pages 3350 to 3353, arguing that the reason, or one of the reasons, the estates was the appropriate entity was because the city had judicially admitted it. And the basis for that argument, and again, and this is in response to the reply brief, the city states, well, we only said that insofar as long as we knew that there was, or we believed the estates was the issue. As soon as we found out the arbors was the appropriate entity, we stopped doing it. That is untrue. The basis of the argument that we had made before Judge Wallach was, which you will find in their appellate brief today on pages 41 to 42, the city says, because the Estates of Creekwoods Board has made a determination as to what the declarations mean, then the homeowners do not have standing to come in here and contest it. Now, that is only applies if the Estates of Creekwoods Board is, or if the Estates of Creekwood is the association in the declaration. And again, you'll see in our summary judgment motion, that's exactly what we relied upon with Judge Wallach. If the Estates of Creekwoods Board is the board that makes the binding declaration, then the Estates of Creekwood has to be the association mentioned. Because the Estates of Creekwood...
They weren't in existence at the time of the dedication, correct?
At the time of the declaration?
Right.
That's right. That's right.
So the declaration pertained to, it's your position, I think, to arbors, correct?
Correct.
And then there's no transfer of any property from arbors to the estates.
If I may, that is correct. If I may answer it this way, with respect to the city, I believe that by judicially admitting that the estates is the appropriate entity, there doesn't need to be a transfer as part of this proceeding. If the city has come in and said, we believe the estates is the appropriate entity for purposes of the standing argument they make continuing to today, by deliberately and continuing to make that argument, they're saying the estates is the association under that document. So,
but
for
it
purposes,
wasn't. I mean, there's no way it could have been.
I agree.
It didn't exist. So you're saying that somehow by them saying that they're the appropriate party, that somehow vests in the estates the R2 lots?
For purposes of this proceeding, and as to the city, yes. I believe that's the whole purpose of judicial admissions. And in fact, in the Kaplan case, that's what there was an issue over stock ownership. And in Justice, I believe it was Holman, said, you said in one certain circumstance that you owned it. You said over here, this estate owned it. We're going to hold you to the ownership issue you took at the beginning.
Can you convey real property by judicial admission?
I don't know of a case exactly on point that says that. I believe, though, again, with respect to this proceeding, it would be binding against the city. If some other third party, interested third party, came in later and filed another proceeding, they may be able to contest that, as they would anyway, because if they were a third party interested with a judicial interest in the property, they wouldn't be bound by this proceeding. But the city is bound by it, and they're bound by their admissions. And furthermore, do I believe, even separate and apart from that, was there a conveyance? According to, I believe, two different cases that we cited in our brief, if, as happened here, the arbor's charter was forfeited, well, under the law, at a minimum, equitable title goes to the owners. And the owners, who are they? And I disagree with Mr. Barrett here because I believe it's pretty clear in the declaration. Ownership in the HOA or membership in the HOA is based on lot ownership, which my clients unquestionably had. That's the whole reason they were called homeowners. If the charter was forfeited, equitable ownership conveyed to them. And as the record also shows, those same lot owners voted to create the second CCRs in 2016, which is part of the summary judgment record. And by voting to create the second CCRs, which refers to the estates as owners, it would affect the same conveyance that the developer conveyed under the first CCRs. Any interest they would have had by voting to say, okay, we're adopting the second CCRs, second declarations, which in here we say the estates owns the common properties, any interest they had would have been conveyed. to the estate by virtue of their ownership and membership of the Equitable property in the arbors. Now, the same should also be true of legal title. We're talking about people who are the whole owners of the arbors. The owners of the arbors are saying, we are creating the second or amended declaration which says the estate owns the common properties. But I certainly believe, to go back to my original statement, if the city has admitted that the estates is the association for purpose of the declaration and for purposes of the city in this lawsuit, the estates should be declared the owner. And I think it's important to remember, too.
What's your best case to support that?
I would say Kaplan, Justice Holman's opinion in Kaplan. And I would also point out the fact that in, I believe it's Boone Enterprises, and this is a Dallas Court of Appeals case. It's important to note the city never appealed that finding of a judicial admission. And the judicial admission was unquestionably a ground for Judge Wallach's opinion. We know that because it was included in our motion, as the pages I cited earlier. But we also know that he specifically agreed with us on that point because it is the basis of an evidentiary objection that he sustained and struck their evidence. And according to the Boone case, because appellant failed to attack a ground for summary judgment the trial court could have relied on, but in this case we know he did, could have relied on to dismiss all of appellee's claims, we must affirm the trial court's judgment. And I don't know how it can be that the court can reverse on an issue that was never appealed. Now, with respect to Mr. Barrett's arguments on whether or not the declaration was a conveyance, he says the R2 lots were explicitly excluded. I believe, I don't want to repeat too far Justice Meyer's statements in the last opinion, but I believe they're absolutely correct. It's true the definition of property does not include R2 lots, but that's not where it ends. He also notes the definition of property is based on the definition of lots, and lots excludes any property owned by the HOA. Any property owned by the HOA held a second title, common properties. And if the common properties are not part of the declaration, then Article 2, Article 5, Article 9 are meaningless because that is all they apply to. There's without question the declaration was meant to apply to property owned by the lot owners, and common property owned by the HOA. With respect to his argument concerning the Lighthouse Church charge case, which we talked about, which I believe was one of the central focuses of the last appeal, that case states, and it does state in general, that a deed to a corporation that doesn't exist is void. But it notes this exception on the page that follows that statement. A deed to a corporation prior to its organization is valid between the parties and title passed when the corporation is legally incorporated. In fact, we researched that issue across the United States and found in the Framington Savings Bank versus Szabo case, which is at 617 F. 2nd 897 out of the First Circuit, that the opposite position is considered the, quote, extreme minority position. I do want to circle back for a moment concerning the standing issue that they have raised, the city has raised. I believe Mr. Baird argued a moment ago that the arbor versus estate issue is an issue that affects standing. We don't believe it does, because if you look at sections 10.01 and 10.04 of the declarations, it ties standing and binding to the declaration, to the declaration to lot ownership, not membership in any HOA, whether it's the arbors or the estates. Lot owners are bound by the declaration. Lot owners are entitled to bring suit to enforce the declaration. Our clients are lot owners, and there's never been any question but that. And with respect to the issue about whether or not the arbors versus the estates is the appropriate entity for standing, it's irrelevant. The only other issue they bring up that point on is respect to the relief. Only one declaration raised that issue. Only one declaration of the four or five that were granted references the estates. The remaining declarations are not affected by that issue, regardless how this court rules on it. And I would point out, Justice Gabriel, I do not believe, if you look at the record, that it was raised that the estates, the arbors was a necessary or indispensable party. I disagree with Mr. Barrett there. They certainly said that that the estates lack standing, or that my clients lack standing because of the estates issue. They certainly said that we weren't entitled to the relief. But nowhere could I find a Rule 37 or 39 mention in their pleadings. And there certainly was no motion presented that there was a necessary, indispensable party that was not present. If I may, I believe I responded to all Mr. Barrett's comments, and if there's anything else that the court would like me to address in my remaining probably minute, I would like to do so now. Otherwise, I'll pass the floor back to Mr. Barrett.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
May it please the court. Counsel. This case has, from the beginning, been a little bit like playing whack-a-mole, and it's difficult to follow all of the issues that have been raised and all of the permutations and as a matter of fact, it's been a little bit like watching a very good deep fake video, and that is that the technical wizardry is fascinating and wonderful to watch, but the content is, pardon the expression, hogwash. I don't even really know exactly where to start, except to say that Mr. Warren's argument, in many respects, attempts to place the burden of proof in this case upon the city defendants rather than on the plaintiffs, where it's supposed to lie. The argument that we have somehow judicially admitted something because we didn't discover it until later in the process of the case, and at that point amended our pleadings. If the court were to buy into that position, it would mean that once you file your pleadings in the case, you're locked in somehow to everything that has been said in that pleading, and you're denied the opportunity to amend your pleadings or change your position based upon the discovery that's conducted in the case. And in order to conform the case to reality as it exists, that cannot, is not now and never has been the law in the state of Texas. I do want to talk about the allegation that we said in a motion for continuance while the case was going up to the Supreme Court. There was a possibility at that point that the Supreme Court could do what Justice Gabriel alluded to earlier, and that is the Supreme Court could have said, we're going to decide these issues now without waiting. That was what that particular allegation in the motion for continuance was, but there was another one that actually you'll see addressed in the briefs, I believe, where I made an inartful sort of statement that the previous Court of Appeals, the first Court of Appeals opinion, was law of the case, and that was because, that was argued at that point, because the facts upon which that original Court of Appeals opinion was based, the fact that the association was never in existence, had no legal existence at all at the time the declaration was signed, that fact could never change. That was established. I'm about out of time, I see here, but rather than going into a he said, she said, and trying to repeat all these things, there are fundamental jurisdictional issues at issue here. They're before the court, and this case should be dismissed. Thank you.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your argument here today. It's been very helpful. Your case has now been submitted, and you are free to go.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.